It's more important these days for a person who wants to be successful in that area to, as they say, build their own platform, where you find an audience for what you're writing or what you're thinking about or your photography, and build that up to the extent that someone will want to take you on, or that it can be sort of self-supporting.
Hi, and welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change, hosted by myself, Ludvig Sundström, and Mikael Syding. Today we talk to Walter Kieschel III, and Walter has more than 30 years of experience in the media industry, first as a business journalist and then as an author. Walter has served as the managing editor of Fortune magazine and the editorial director of Harvard Business Publishing, which of course includes the very famous Harvard Business Review that you might have heard of. He's also authored the two books Lords of Strategy, which we'll talk about in the next episode, and Office Hours, A Guide in the Managerial Life. In this episode, we'll talk about Walter's background before getting into the media industry and the story of how he made the decision of going to work for Fortune magazine instead of taking a higher paying job at a large consulting firm. You'll also learn how a big business publication or newspaper like Fortune magazine or Harvard Business Review runs. And then you'll learn how Walter pursued a so-called portfolio career and helped to start what became perhaps America's most successful business newsletter. We also hear Walter's career advice to someone who wants to work in the media industry and how the conventional career path has changed. And finally, we hear about his first impression of the legendary founder of the Boston Consulting Group, Bruce D. Henderson, and why Walter thought that Bruce was kind of mad, but despite this, how Bruce became super successful by relying on his top two strengths. We also hear about this meeting with Bill Bain, the founder of Bain & Company, and what set Bill Bain apart from all the other lords of strategy. This episode will be particularly interesting if you want to get into the media business and understand how it works, especially business publications. Please welcome Walter to the show. So let's start with your background, Walter. What was it like for you when you were growing up? What did you want to do?
I didn't really have a clear sense at an early age or through my teenage years of exactly what I wanted to do or be. I wasn't one of those people who, you know, at the age of four decided I wanted to be an engineer. I had a sense of things that I was interested in and other things that I was less interested in. And over my teens and 20s, I began to develop more of a sense of what I might be good at and which of the things that I enjoyed doing the most I might be good at. Even in my teens, I had been encouraged by teachers in my high school to do public speaking and to write for my classes. And so I enjoyed that. And then when I went to college, I actually ended up concentrating on history and literature as my main subjects.
Were you surprised that you liked writing and public speaking, or did you kind of know it beforehand when the teacher said so?
I think I kind of knew it beforehand. I had been in, you know, student plays and productions of ludicrous plays, Hansel and Gretel, and a play called The King's Cream Puffs when I was, eight or nine or 10. And I enjoyed acting in those. And on the other hand, I'm probably the least coordinated person you know. I was horribly unathletic, and so I knew that I wasn't cut out to become a good football player, or even though I did do sports all the way through school, but I did them very badly.
Okay. Did you read a lot?
I did read a lot from an early age. I was effectively an only child. My sister was born 8.5 years after I was, and then my brother was born about 18 months after that. So for the first 8 or so years of my life, I was an only child, and I loved to read. And my parents encouraged me in that and took me to the library, and I spent quite a lot of time poring over books.
What kind of books was it, like detective stories, Biggles, or sci-fi?
More, it was a series on history and biography. There was a wonderful series of American books called The Landmark Histories, and they would take various episodes of American history, the Lewis and Clark expeditions, the California Gold Rush, and write an entire narrative book about that. Or biographies, again, principally of American actors and political figures. It was called a signature series. And on the cover of the book about Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or Ulysses S. Grant, they'd have a copy of his or her signature. So
that's pretty cool.
It was. They were wonderful books.
Yeah. And then you graduate and you get your first job. What was your first job?
Well, I went to college on a Navy scholarship. In the United States, there is a program called the Navy Reserve Officer Training Corps, and they offer scholarships to private universities or public universities, where they, and it was a very generous scholarship. They paid all of my tuition, and then but as part of the agreement, you get some naval training while you're in school, but then you have an obligation to serve on active duty for 4 years after that. So I enjoyed my time in the Navy so much that I turned it into 5 years and at one point thought of making that my career. But that was really my first job after college.
What did you do there?
For 3.5 years, I was an officer on destroyers, both of which were older than I was. They were end of World War II Knox-class destroyers, but they were still in service, though a lot of the systems aboard them, like the gun mounts and torpedo tubes, didn't really work very well. But I had a wonderful time. There was an admiral in the Navy at that time. He was the chief of naval operations. He used to talk about the fun and zest of going to sea. And I found that to be really quite true.
Do you think it's surprising that you were like a bookish kid, but then ended up on a destroyer? Or do you think that actually was a natural development for you?
I think it was a slightly natural development. The United States Navy sort of prides itself, and it wouldn't say this publicly, but I can say it. They kind of believe that they are the most intellectual of the three or four services. And I suspect that in Britain, the Royal Navy thinks the same thing. And I don't know about the Swedish Navy, but I suspect they may harbor that view too. In that, you know, taking a ship to sea today or 400 years ago requires quite a lot of technological and technical expertise and thoughtfulness, and in a way that perhaps sending an infantry company into combat does not. So, I mean, there were intellectual challenges to it, and it was also adventurous. And my reading had been about adventure. I grew up in a suburb of Washington, D.C. Suburbs weren't particularly adventurous, but I was sort of hungry for something that would take me to far places and put me in situations that I had not been or seen before.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but then you spend the next 17 years climbing to the top of Fortune magazine, right?
Well, no, there was a break. After that, I got out of the Navy because I realized that I wouldn't, if I stayed in the Navy, I'd be spending more and more time on shore duty and less time at sea. So I enrolled in what was called a joint program, a 4-year program that rewarded you at the end of it with a law degree, but also with an MBA. Normally, if you just went to law school, that would be 3 years. This is in the United States. If you just went to business school, that would be 2 years. But by combining these two in the so-called joint program at my university, you could get a degree in 4 years or get 2 degrees in 4 years. So I went and did that. And that was partly career confusion because the people in that program, our friends who were just at the law school would say, "What are you doing going to the business school? And don't you want to be a lawyer?" And friends at the business school would say, "Well, why are you messing with this law school?" I used to joke that if the program had a shield or an armorial device on it, it would have the Latin in it for keep your options open. So I did that for 4 years, actually.
That must have been pretty intense.
It was pretty intense. It was a hardworking program, but rewarding. And I learned a lot. And I learned a lot about what I liked and what I didn't like. I learned, for instance, that I wasn't going to be a very good lawyer. I wasn't fussy enough. And reading contract language put me to sleep within about 2 minutes. But I enjoyed very much my classes at the business school and learning about that. And then it was, I think, in reflecting on my career in preparation for you know, our conversation today, I was thinking about it. I think I've been guided by having a sense of what I did enjoy and what I liked doing and might be good at doing, and then having happy accidents occur to me that put me in a position where I could pursue those things. The happy accident that sent me to Fortune magazine was, this is a four-year program, and after the second year of the program, I couldn't get a summer job anywhere other than as a research associate at the Harvard, or at my business school, working for a visiting professor who needed some courses or cases written for his course. So I wrote, over the course of the summer, three or four cases for him. I didn't think that he liked my work very much, didn't think that he and I necessarily got along very well, and I didn't even take the course that I wrote the cases for. But then in my senior year, my last year of the four, I'd spent the summer as an intern at a small, rich, prestigious New York law firm, and that convinced me I didn't want to practice law. The other job I was looking at was as a management consultant. Management consulting firms were hiring a lot of MBAs then. And rather to my surprise, I got an offer from a management consulting firm. And my peers congratulated me upon that and everything. But I went by one day to talk to the professor for whom I'd written the cases. And he said, well, Walter, I'd like you to, why don't you go down and talk to a couple of my friends at Time Incorporated? You might have an interest in some sort of journalism or work with them. And as it turns out, my visiting professor was, as I had known, a former managing editor at Fortune magazine, and he was still on the board of directors at Time Incorporated. So I paid my $50 myself to get on the Eastern Airlines shuttle from Boston to New York. I went down, and he set me up with two people at the company. One was the editor-in-chief, a man named Hedley Donovan, who was Henry Luce's successor on Earth, and the other was the number two editor, Ralph Graves. And they talked to me, and they said, well, you don't have any journalistic experience. I'd never written for the college newspaper or high school newspaper. And you don't really have any business experience, so, but we'll offer you a job. And they did, and it was going to be less than half of what the consulting firm was going to pay me. I did manage to talk them to throwing in an extra $500 into the offer, so it would be exactly half, so I could say that to my wife. And when I was thinking over the offer from Time Incorporated, all of my business school friends said, oh, wait, that's a terrible idea. How is this going to look on your resume? You can go to work for this consulting firm. That's very prestigious. But the offer as a job of a researcher reporter at Time Incorporated seemed much more entertaining, thrilling, potentially adventurous, that I took it. And then I had an incredibly happy 17 years at Time Inc. and Fortune magazine.
Can you understand your friends at all when they thought it was a terrible idea?
Oh, yes. I mean, business school students, like students at a lot of other institutions, are very susceptible to peer pressure, don't you think? And particularly with respect to critical issues like what job you're going to get. So that if you have an offer from a prestigious consulting firm, and those were about the most prestigious offers aside from ones from investment banking houses that business school students could get in those eras, why would a sane person turn down such an offer for what seemed like a very low-level job filled with uncertainty on the other hand.
But then you stayed for 17 years for Fortune magazine, and that's a long time in one company. So you must have really liked it.
I did. Well, and back in those days, it wasn't necessarily. I mean, there had been people who had 20, 30, 40-year careers at Time Incorporated and at other journalistic institutions. It wasn't really until the late 80s and the early 90s that the traditional employer-employee contract, if you will, informal or formal, began to kind of come apart, and companies began to not feel that they had to offer lifetime employment to people. But yes, I had just almost from the beginning a wonderful time at Fortune magazine.
Could you tell us a few things about how a newspaper or a business publication runs and how the different people work together?
Yes, it is at once a collaborative and a solitary enterprise. It is collaborative in the sense that there are typically meetings. At Fortune, the editors would meet every morning at 10 o'clock to go, and even though we were a magazine that was only published every 2 weeks, but we would meet to talk about the stories that or the articles that were underway, the progress of those, or things that were in the news that we might want to try to write about the magazine at some point. At the New York Times, as I understand it, they have a morning meeting and then they have an afternoon meeting. So the editors are talking among themselves about which articles do we put forward and where do we go with that. Meanwhile, journalists have an assignment. They have an assignment editor, and they typically, you know, traditionally they've oftentimes worked alone. Increasingly now, they sort of work in teams and they go out and talk to people, gather facts, gather information. But then it ends up with some person sitting in front of a computer, or maybe two or three people collaboratively writing up an article. It's also true that, in my experience, and I've shared this with, and I've seen other editors and people who have been in charge of publications have told me this too, that journalists hate to be managed. They just do not, they don't like to have like a boss, or good journalists don't. They're similar to, say, software engineers in that respect. They're kind of individual creators. And so to the extent that they are managed or their work is coordinated, it has to be done with a kind of a deft hand and patience and helpfulness.
How does that work when you're a manager for them?
Well, one of the things that I found is when you, if you're editing someone's manuscript or work, bad editors, and back in those days, this is in the early 80s and into the late 80s, we still worked on paper quite a lot. That was before the internet and before email, and you could do all that on your computer. But a bad editor would take a writer's first draft or manuscript and cross things out and say, no, it doesn't work. And then he would write or she would write in her words instead of the writer's and substitute those. A good editor, by contrast, would more often not cross things out, but ask a question. Is that the word exactly that you mean? I can't quite understand this paragraph and what happened to the people there. Could you make it a little clearer for me? And try to, almost in a Socratic way, have the writer work through the issues and present the better alternatives.
Can that method be taught to the editors, or is it dependent on a certain personality trait?
It clearly intersects with personality traits, but I think it can be taught. Actually, the best way, and the way that I was taught to edit, and this is probably not done very much these days, but was to sit in an office with an editor and sit next to her or him at their computer or his desk and watch him or her as they work through the manuscript and how they saw the problems there and how they thought about them and so on. So I think that if you have that kind of hands-on training, or it can be done in the age of electronic mail and all on the computer. You can provide examples to young and developing editors of those kinds of techniques, or you can just have conversations with them about it. One of the things that I was very interested in, because I wrote a lot about management, I was interested in managerial techniques and what worked and what didn't work, installing at Fortune a system whereby sometimes it's called upward appraisal, where the writers would be canvassed after they'd worked with an editor about what that kind of experience was like. And then this would be filtered. A human resources person would ask these questions. So their anonymity was preserved and so on. But I think that was the first time, at Fortune at least, that the editors began to get some feedback on how their work was perceived and received by the people that they were supervising. And that made a difference.
What was a typical day like when you were the managing editor of Fortune magazine?
Well, it would begin with an editor's meeting. I also had this belief that the managing editor should read every word that appeared in the magazine, either as, not necessarily in the final draft, but as a first draft. And so I would spend a lot of time reading copy. It was also true that one of the things that the work of management I found there, and I think it's generally true too, is one of relentless interactive demands. I remember reading a book review, I think in the Times Literary Supplement years ago, of a biography of the woman who founded the Penguin Children's Book line. And this was a very successful, set the pattern for children's books in England post-war. And she was the top person there for many years. And one of her sons said to her at some point, "Oh, my goodness, mother, it must be great to be the top person." And she said, "Well, yes and no. What you find is that you constantly have people asking you for things. Those are those relentless interactive demands. And that can be a bit wearing if you don't know quite, you know, how to respond to them, or you haven't thought through how to respond to them." One of the things that people we might talk about, and Henry Mintzberg, a Canadian scholar of management, did this beautiful book on how chief executive officers actually use their time. And he tracked and followed around, shadowed for 2 or 3 weeks, I think 5 different Canadian chief executive officers. And one of his startling discoveries was, for all the pronouncements in the management texts about how you want to set aside an hour for this and 20 minutes for that, deliberation, everything, that CEOs spent over half of their time in encounters that were less than 7 minutes long. People asking them for questions, or they're asking other people questions, just brief information grubbing encounters. And so there were a lot of those, as you might imagine, as managing editor.
What's your conclusion, and what is Mintzberg's conclusion regarding that? Is it a good thing? I mean, it's become that way de facto. So are the 7-minute meetings a good thing?
Yes, I believe they are, if they're done properly, because they can give you a lot of information that's quite up to date. You can meaningfully communicate your thoughts on subjects to people. It oftentimes doesn't take more than 7 minutes. I believe it is. There was another book by a Harvard Business School professor, John Cotter, called The General Managers. And he did sort of the same thing that Mintzberg did and followed around 13 general managers. These were people with division-wide responsibilities, profit and loss responsibilities. And 13 executives who were thought by their companies to be real stars. And what he found was that they were engaging in this kind of behavior as well, these constant, and that those of them who had the largest networks, who knew the most people, and who engaged in the most of these, the most kinds of these conversations, were really the most successful at getting things done. Now, of course, there are dangers. There was another, you probably know, Warren Bennis, who was a wonderful writer and thinker about management issues, University of Southern California most of his career. But Warren, at one point early on, he was basically a professor, but then he accepted an offer to become the president of the University of Cincinnati in Ohio, because he thought, I can really change this institution. I'm ready to put into practice all my management ideas. And so he went there and became president. And then, as he describes it, from the first day, people kept bringing into his office their wet babies. This is my problem. I need help with it. This is a situation that needs to be changed. And so Warren got caught up in the trivia and in the weeds of helping people change their wet babies, get them into dry diapers or nappies, so much that he never got a chance to raise his eyes to the sky and look at the larger issues and pursue those. So it wasn't a very happy time for him or the university, and I think he left the job after 2 or 3 years.
And then you wrote the book, which is called Office Hours, A Guide in Managerial Life. Is this related to the same topics?
It is, sort of. Office Hours began as a column that I wrote in, even while I was editing, I wanted to keep reporting and writing. And so I started up a column, and it ran once a month. And it was on the sort of issues or dilemmas that a manager faces in their day-to-day life. It had everything to do with, how do you fire someone? How do you react if you yourself are fired? What do you do if you, what are the first things to do after if you're promoted? What are the first things to do if you are passed over for a promotion? How do you deal with an executive alcoholic? And I was very proud of that column, in part, and it was very useful because I would, unlike a lot of columns, which are just kind of an expression of the author's point of view, I would actually go out and do reporting. I would typically interview 10 or 20 people, academic experts, real live business people who had experience in this area, and get their insights. And then I was able to kind of boil them down and distill them into, I think, 1,500 words. And I had a great deal of fun with that. And then eventually a book publisher was interested in collecting the columns. And so the book was published as a collection of those columns.
How did you find the contact information for the people that you interviewed? Was it just hard work, basically?
Sometimes, but they're also, you can find that they're interim and helpful agencies. At that point, there were three or four essentially communications or public relations firms, all of them rather weirdly based in New Hampshire, who represented colleges and universities throughout the United States, and in particular, the faculty members of those. And so it was fairly easy to, with a few calls to Keene, New Hampshire, to come up with three or four or five academic experts on burnout, administrative professionals. But then also I would go out and look for and ask for examples of real people, executives who might be interesting and good to talk to on this subject. And I had a certain amount of latitude. I wasn't doing kind of conventional reporting on a particular company, so I could, in certain cases, I could let these people be quoted anonymously or so on. But in most cases, they would go on the record. And it was very, you know, I would know that I was kind of onto the correct take on the subject if after 15 or 20 interviews, they all begin to sound alike and their advice was sort of similar.
Then you became the managing editor the director of Harvard Business Review.
Yeah, that was kind of curious, an interesting, again, an accidental progression too. I mean, I was very happy in my career at Fortune. I had risen through the ranks. And but then shortly after I became not even a year into my tenure as managing editor, Time Incorporated, for the first time in its existence, went outside the company to bring in a new editor-in-chief. And that editor-in-chief, perhaps understandably, perhaps not, but he wanted his own people in the managing editor jobs of most of the publications. And there were 7 key magazines at Time Inc. at that point. Besides Fortune, there was Time, Time and Sports Illustrated and People and Entertainment Weekly and so on. And within 18 months, he had replaced 6 out of the 7 managing editors. And I was just had the honor of being the first to go. So I was the first one replaced. So I found myself, I didn't have a job, but I was casting about, well, what do I want to do now? And I had written about people who put together what were sometimes called portfolio careers. They weren't working for just one organization. They were working for, they worked for 2 or 3 or 4. Quite deliberately. And so I decided that would be interesting to try out. And so I had, in the last days of my time at Time Incorporated, become very interested in the newsletter business, which was the fastest growing form of print publication in the United States back in the mid-90s. This was before the internet came in. And I'd been trying to encourage my colleagues at Time Inc. to look at newsletters. They couldn't care less. But Harvard Business Publishing had developed a kind of an interest in maybe starting a newsletter in addition to the Harvard Business Review. So some people from there approached me, and I agreed to work with them on a consulting basis to launch a newsletter, which we did do. We launched a monthly management newsletter. So I started working for them part-time, only half of my time. And then after a year or two, the chief executive officer of the company said to me, oh, wouldn't you become the publisher of the Harvard Business Review on the business side? And I thought that the Harvard Business Review could use some. So I agreed to that. And then 2 years after that, we reorganized the company and I became the editorial director for the all of our publications, which included the Harvard Business Review.
Hmm. Was that a lot of responsibility?
It was a lot of responsibility. There, I wasn't doing hands-on editing, but I was sort of overseeing. Harvard Business Publishing had, besides the review, we had a book publishing line, we had a newsletter family of newsletters that was growing, we had a conference business. So, yes, I was in a more managerial role there, a less editorial role. And in some ways, Harvard Business Publishing was a more challenging place, as I think the people who worked there would admit, because on the one hand, they had been set up in the early 90s as like a wholly independent subsidiary of the Harvard Business School. They had their own board of directors, their own headquarters and human resources policies and all that. But at the same time, there was always this kind of looking over your shoulder at what the people at the Harvard Business School, particularly the tenured faculty, thought about what you were doing. So, and it was very important that we earn money, which all went back to the school to support its educational programs. But on the other hand, somehow we weren't exactly supposed to act like a profit-making organization. One of the head of human resources joked that we never talked about making a profit, but just accruing a prudent surplus. There were different kind of strains there that needed to be managed.
Could you just explain the newsletter business, how that worked? Who were the writers? Who were the clients? And how did it fit into like a company like Harvard Business Review?
Well, it was very interesting because, as you know, if you read the Harvard Business Review, the Harvard Business Review really has, or at least in those days particularly, didn't have anyone on its own staff who wrote much of anything. It just had editors. And they would solicit articles or just have unsolicited manuscripts arrive from some of the best thinkers on management around the world. And then the real job of the Harvard Business Review editors would be to pick the right articles and then to sort of shape them. And sometimes they would go out and commission articles or ask experts to write an article about something. And it was a very prestigious thing for a management expert to have an article published in the review, and also a lucrative thing in ways I can talk about if you want. But the newsletters decided, and the people I was working with, Jim Biolis and others, should be staff written. So we would, I wrote a number of the articles myself in the first year. Again, kind of like the office hours columns, distilling research, doing interviews, talking to people, and then we'd hire freelance writers to do the same thing. It was an 8-page newsletter, and it was quickly successful right out of the blocks. I think we had 50,000 subscribers by after the first year, and it a subscription cost I think $80, which was less than the Harvard Business Review, but it wasn't insubstantial.
That's great.
And it was a different model. And talk about the tensions. Some of the people at the Harvard Business Review said, "Oh, what is this? Who is this? Who wrote this article? Or, I mean, who is this writer I've never heard of?" It would be a talented freelance writer. This isn't Gary Hamel or Michael Porter or some other well-known guru who would be the author of the Harvard Business Review article. And that, I think, would have the newsletters, Harvard a medical school had some very successful health newsletters and all that. They were going along quite brilliantly until the advent of the internet, because all of a sudden on the internet you could get much of the same kind of information that newsletters provided, but you could get it immediately and free and surf and find exactly what you wanted. So while there are still some newsletters around, they've been mostly eclipsed by online information.
Speaking of that, do you have any advice to young listeners who want to get into the media business or maybe become a writer?
I do have advice. I think these days it is important for you to not look to, well, 20 or 30 years ago, the sort of conventional career path for someone who wanted to get into media or be a writer for not just a business publication, but a newspaper or a magazine would be perhaps you would write for the college newspaper, then you would get a job at a newspaper in a smaller city, and you would do well there, and then you would go to a newspaper at a larger city, and then eventually the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or the Los Angeles Times would recruit you to join their editorial staff. And that was heaven. That was the height. These days, that model is less applicable, though it still works to some extent. It's more important these days for a person who wants to be successful in that area to, as they say, build their own platform. To whether it's by writing a blog, by having a podcast, by doing something, I suppose, even on Instagram, where you find an audience for what you're writing or what you're thinking about or your photography, and build that up to the extent that someone will, either a social media site or someone will want to take you on, or that it can be sort of self-supporting. In 2001, Harvard Business School Press published a really prescient book by Tom Davenport and John Beck. It was called The Attention Economy. And Davenport and Beck argued that going forward, in some ways, the most critical and scarce resource in our economy was going to be the attention of potential customers or, for media people, readers or listeners. And that their competition for their attention was going to become, if anything, more intense and desperate. So you really need to build your own platform, if you will, create your own entity and find an audience for that. For writers of one of the things that we told people whose books we were publishing at Harvard Business School Press, and these were typically business professors or consultants or business writers who had an interesting idea, is that it was really important for them to, if they had a consulting firm, to get out there behind it and buy 1,000 copies of the books, or provide them with speaking opportunities where they can go out and find an audience for their material.
So they essentially help with PR.
Well, is building a platform PR? Or I guess it is. It's certainly a form of marketing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's marketing. Yeah. We used to argue, consultants and others would say that, and I think it's even more important these days, the best leave behind, is, in the marketing term, the best brochure you can leave behind with a potential client is a book you've written on a subject. Shows that you're serious, you've thought about it considerably, and someone has been impressed enough to actually publish the book.
Right. Speaking of that, then you wrote this book, The Lords of Strategy. And this is a book about the history of consulting. And you did more than 100 interviews for this book. So I'm wondering, to begin with, how did you prepare for these interviews?
Well, I'll tell you about that, but let me just say, I thought of it as a book about the history of the idea of strategy and the different iterations of strategy that have been developed since the 1960s. Now, it just so happens that management consultants were very active in the development of those ideas in ways that I don't think had been widely understood or much written about before. So it does, you're absolutely right. There, a lot of the book is about the history of consulting firms, but that I hope in service to talking about the larger discussion of what ideas they were coming up with and how effective were they. The way I would prepare for the interviews is I would look over if there was any writing or essays by the person, the consultant, or the business school professor I was going to talk to. I would look those over, read them in some cases. And typically for each interview, I would prepare two or three pages, single-spaced, typed a set of questions, maybe 15 or 20 questions, which I would give to the person in advance to let her or him think about the answers and frame up the discussion. And then, of course, when we actually sat down to talk, we would cover those subjects, but then we could move on to other things and questions that were just they hadn't seen beforehand.
Did you have that format down from the get-go, or maybe you started out with too many questions or too few questions?
Well, one of the things that I found was that of the three major strategy consulting firms, only one of them was kind of enthusiastic from the beginning about letting me talk to some of their consultants and their people. Back in, I think I got the book contract in 2004. Even then, the major consulting firms, while they were putting out more communications and publishing more things, they weren't necessarily so sure that they wanted to be interviewed or have their people talked to. So by telling them that I would prepare this detailed list of questions in advance, I think that gave them some assurance. It also, in the cases of firms that wanted to have a PR person sit in on the interview, they knew what it was going to be about and so on. And so I think that having the sets of questions actually helped in finally persuading each of the three firms and other firms that I talked to and other people to talk to me in ways that they might not have otherwise.
We made an episode about the experience curve a couple of weeks ago in which we mentioned Bruce Henderson, and you met him in person, right? And what was your first impression about him?
I first met Bruce Henderson in 1976 when I was actually interviewing for a job at the Boston Consulting Group when I was still in business school and law school. And I thought he was kind of mad. I mean, in the sense of he was kind of incoherent. He had talked about these terrific ideas, but not very clearly, and talked about the growth of the firm, but there were limits, and you know, how long does it take a set of lily pads to cover Lake Superior, and what do we do on the limits of growth? And then subsequently, I didn't interview him for the book because he had already died by the time I got to work on it, but I did interview him a couple of times at Fortune Magazine, and he was a terrible interview. He wouldn't be responsive to the questions, and he would launch into these discussions of what he was interested in, and you weren't exactly clear of what the references were or what he was referring to. One of his colleagues, George Stock, said later on there, talking to Bruce, you had to remember the Henderson uncertainty principle, which is a little bit like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You might have a sense of where Bruce Henderson was going in the conversation, but at the same time, you could never have a sense of exactly where he was or was starting from or what is his essential set. Or you might have a sense of kind of what subject he was thinking about, but you'd have no sense of where he was going. You could never have a sense of both of those things at the same time in talking to him.
So how could he become successful with these traits?
With these traits, he placed a great attachment on writing And the most effective means of communicating what the Boston Consulting Group was all about were a series of pamphlets called Perspectives. That he wrote a number of them at the beginning. But I believe the fifth or sixth person who was hired by the Boston Consulting Group was a consulting editor to help Henderson in particular write these perspective pamphlets as clearly as possible. And the perspectives were terrific. They were, you could fold them up and put them in your coat pocket. They were that short, maybe, I don't know, 800, 900 words, but they were crisp. They were contentious to some extent. They made the case for things like the experience curve or the fact that if you were the if you were not the low-cost producer in a particular industry or market, that your chances of ever succeeding in that market were very small. And so he communicated through these perspectives. And by also through the people that he hired, who were oftentimes much more kind of coherent and better at explaining their ideas, and they had some great ideas than he was. It's interesting, I don't think Bruce Henderson ever published what we'd call a written-through book, a book that was written through as a book, but though collections of perspectives were published. But many of the, there were a number of eminent book authors who did come from the Boston Consulting Group and did publish some wonderful, wonderful books.
So Bruce found that his big communication strength was writing, and he was also talented hiring people.
Yes, exactly.
And then you met Bill Bain, correct?
I did, and that was very interesting. I met Bill first, again, when I was reporting for Fortune. I did a story on strategy, I think in, it may have been late 80s or something. And paradoxically, the principal business magazines in the United States at that time, which included Business Week and Forbes and Fortune, never had really written systematically about corporate strategy or the ideas around it, much less the consulting firms. And so I approached Bain, and they really did not want to talk to me. They were coming out of their, initially Bain was extraordinarily secretive. I think I tell stories in the book about their consultants wouldn't even carry business cards. They believed that their ideas were so helpful to their clients and were going to be so successful in helping their clients compete the pants off their competitors that just the knowledge that someone was working with Bain would be, in effect, a security matter. So I'm not sure that Bill had ever done a press interview before. Maybe he had done some with smaller outlets or the Boston Globe, but I remember going into his office, which was large, and he sat behind the desk at the end of the room, and there was sort of intimidation factor in there, but at the same time, he was utterly charming. And as I write in the book, one of the strengths of Bain was Bill Bain figured out when he was actually, before he was a consultant, when he was raising money for Vanderbilt University, that he really liked chief executives, top executives, and they really liked him. So he could be extremely charming and engaging. And when I went to do the book, this was after he was no longer the head of Bain, but he was very gracious and generous with his time. I think I spent 10 or 15 hours with him, either in his apartment in Boston or in his home in Naples, Florida, and interviewing him and going over the past. So he was a complicated man, and rather more secretive, but also more coherent than Bruce Henderson.
That was my, by far, favorite part of the book, where you go into Bain Company. I think their business model is really interesting and cool.
It was. It was very interesting. And they were the first of the major strategy consulting firms, the major firms who say that they would only work for one client in an industry or a competitive set, but they also weren't going to come in and just do a simple project for you and leave you with a report. That was their rap on the Boston Consulting Group, that the Boston Consulting Group, and they, you know, as the book talks about, most of the first Bain people came out of the Boston Consulting Group. But they would say, yeah, Boston Consulting Group comes in, they'll do a brilliant analysis, they'll leave you with a report, and then they fly back to Boston. But we're not going to do that. We are going to come in and we're going to study your operations in even greater depth and your strategic issues. And we want a commitment that you're going to be, you know, retain us for a year or more or however long it takes. And we will really go deeply into your operations, and we will start producing not just reports, but tangible results, ways that you see that performance of your organization is changing and improving.
All right, that concludes this first part of our conversation with Walter Kieschel. We will continue our discussion with Walter next week in a second episode, and then we'll talk more in depth about his popular book, Lords of Strategy, which has achieved more than 1,500 reviews on Goodreads, among other things, and we'll talk about where he sees the future of strategy consulting going. Don't forget to subscribe to our episode summaries at www.futureskillspodcast.com/newsletter, and you can find a link to that in our episode description as always. Thanks for listening and see you next week.